Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm having a good time, and we're going to continue at this hour. What we're doing right now, what's making me have a good time, is we're talking with folks who are coming into the church at Easter and answering questions. I'm not answering the questions. Joe's answering the questions. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. You know, Joe's got this super popular book out now. Really, a lot of people love this book. The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, The Catholic Witness of the Fathers in Christianity's First Two Centuries. And I think part of the reason it's so popular is there's this kind of, I think, manufactured ignorance where it's not convenient always for Christian leaders to say, you know, we actually do know a lot about the first two centuries of the church. So we act like, it's all dark. I don't know what that was like. It was, you know, it probably looked exactly like our church, you know, whatever our church is. But Joe makes very clear, no, there's a lot that we know about the earliest Christian church, and it's Catholic. That's the thing. When you look at it, you go, oh, that early Christian church, the church before the year 100, the church before the year 200, that was a Catholic church. So I think that's why the book is so popular. Also, Joe's a great writer. The early church was the Catholic church. You should get it. But today, Joe's here to talk to folks and answer questions about the Catholic church, people who are coming into the church. If you're one of those and you're just tuning in with us, the lines are being held for you. If you're coming into the church at Easter and you want to ask something, this is bugging me. This I'm not sure about. This I never quite could get my head around. You got one of those? Give us a call, 888-318-7884. Joe, thanks for coming back for the second hour.
My pleasure.
You'd probably get fired if you didn't, but I'm glad you did. Jerry in Dallas, Texas wants to ask you a question. Are you ready to start up again? Ask questions?
Let's do
questions?
It, please.
All right. Jerry in Dallas, Texas, watching on YouTube. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
I don't want to take up too much time from other callers, so I'll be as quick as I can. I'm 16, and my entire family is Protestant. During quarantine, I started researching interdenominational disputes, and that research inevitably led me to the Catholic Church.
That, you are a rare wow. bird, Jerry. Not that many people read their way into the Catholic Church. Usually take that's an extraordinary thing. God bless you.
Well,
for
especially
that.
Just like I think about all the ways I spent quarantine, and I don't think I did as good of a job as you, Jerry.
I know, right? I watched Tiger King, or was it Lion King, or no Tiger? What's
you
it
probably
called?
Probably watched both.
I probably did watch both. Now I messed up my own stupid joke. Sorry, Jerry. By the way. Jerry in Dallas, Texas. I know a Jerry in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Thanks for adding that, Si. Yeah. Jerry, please continue.
Okay, go ahead, Jerry.
I actually just finished your book today, Joe. The Early Church Was the Catholic Church.
Oh, wonderful. I hope you liked it.
Very good book.
Very good.
I really did. And I have your book too, Si, and I plan on reading it soon.
Well, come into the church first and then read it. That way you're safe.
In case you're scandalized.
All right, Jerry, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Okay, so my question is, how can God have one will and Christ have two wills without us saying that the Father and the Holy Spirit also have a human will?
Oh, that's a great question. And this gets to what's so mysterious and hard to understand about the incarnation. So in the early days of Christianity, one of the objections the Romans made was that we believed in a God who changed, and not only changed, but a God who came down out of heaven. And the Christian response was, no, that's not what we mean by this. When Jesus takes on a human nature, when the second person of the Trinity becomes Jesus of Nazareth, that becoming is not a change in his divinity. He remains exactly the same in his divinity that he was before, which is, you know, hypostatically part of this one divine substance with one will that is who he is in his divinity. But the second person of the Trinity takes to himself a human nature, a second nature. And he's hypostatically united with that, but not in a way that the humanity becomes part of the divinity. You don't have a blending of the natures, if that makes sense. This was monophysitism is what this was condemned as. And like the idea that the human and divine natures of Christ are blended, or that the divinity somehow becomes either less divine or a, you know, 50-50 kind of mixture, or anything like that. That's not what's going on here. And I think that's worth just acknowledging that that's a hard thing to grasp. So when we're talking about this, a nature is, you know, what you are and a person is who you are. Now, that's even there, maybe a little bit of an oversimplification, but the best way to understand it, I think. So there's three who's in the Trinity and one what. And one of those three who's takes to himself a second what. In addition to a divine what, he now has a human what as well. That's, I don't know if that's more confusing or more helpful to describe it that way. But so the second person takes to himself a nature in his personhood. He doesn't blend his divine nature and his human nature.
Jerry?
Does that clarify it, or is that just more confusing?
Yeah, and I know my mind can't fully grasp every single mystery of the Godhead, and I won't know many things until the life to come. I just enjoy reading and talking about these questions like these. So thank you for answering.
And Jerry, just to be clear, you're coming into the church at Easter?
Yes, sir.
And your family, how are they with this?
I've actually talked to my mom, and she is planning on becoming Catholic thanks to the Holy Spirit.
Wow.
That's best case scenario. That's fantastic.
Wow. Yeah. Jerry.
I talked to both my mom and my older brother about it.
Check the job postings at Catholic Answers every now and then. We'll be looking for new.
I would love to.
Yeah, well, you sound like you got the chops, man. Thanks for the call. God bless you, and welcome home to the Catholic Church.
Thank you. God bless you, too.
Thank you, Jerry. Let's go to, we got time before we have to go to another break. Let's go to Jerry in Cleveland, that was just Jerry we were talking to, Patrick in Cleveland, Ohio, listening on The Rock, 1260 AM. Patrick, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, y'all, how y'all doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I will be coming into the church this Easter. I'm 25. Coming from Protestant, and I'm a former agnostic.
Well, welcome home and congratulations.
Wow, welcome home. That's beautiful.
Yeah. My question is a little bit personal. It's really more so asking advice. How do I get over the fear of Mary?
That's a very common kind of fear, and I think a very common question. So just to make sure I understand you right, you mean like saying prayers to Mary and everything? You mean you're not afraid she's going to like... you know, haunt you or something. You're just afraid of like, am I going to displease God if I, you know, say the rosary or something. Like, is that right?
Like even somewhat yes and no, more so like asking, like there's this fear in me of asking for her intercession, which probably has something to do with my past and that I've dealt with, you know.
Are you afraid it will be idolatry, Patrick?
That or just, well, to be blunt, like my past sexual sins I've dealt with, like me, sinner who struggle with sexual sins, asking the woman who gave birth to God.
I gotcha, Patrick. But
it's been such a chokehold on my conscience where when I've dealt with temptation, my mind has gone, pray the rosary, but I'm so hesitant to pray it.
Oh, Patrick, that's a very, okay, I understand the question now. You understand, Joe?
Yeah, I do, and I think that's really good. And here I would just say, like, you're not going to, like, shock Mary, you know? Like, she's changed diapers. She's not, like, going to be, like, horrified by the idea just because she is ever virgin and sinless. So I think it's worth... it's hard to describe the thing I'm trying to say right here, but I think there's two things. One is that very holy people have a certain kind of comfort around sinners that coexists with a revulsion of sin, that Jesus can go and like dine with tax collectors and prostitutes, and they're able to be at home with him. That people who've commit these kind of sexual sins that has a lot of shame attached to it, they find a companion with Jesus, right? And so too, with Mary, with all the saints, they model that. They show that. That's like, if we are like that, if we are just like keeping sinners at a distance, we're not living the life of the saints, right? Like we're not there yet. And because they are so comfortable with sinners, including the kind of sins that we feel the most kind of shame around, which are usually bodily sins. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second one that a lot of sexual sin degrades the way that we view the opposite sex. And so it has this objectifying, demeaning depiction of women. And in the face of that, it's what would be better than holding up a beautiful, pure image of femininity and seeing the thing that like all sexual sin is parodying and kind of mocking, that like you're seeing the real thing in the face of the counterfeit. And I think it's actually incredibly purifying for you as a man to see like femininity is not something to be like, you know, dominated and objectified and consumed. It's something to be respected and even venerated. That's, I think, something Mary kind of reveals to us. And we get these words of comfort both from Jesus and from Mary. So in John 19, when we see Mary at the foot of the cross, Jesus says to the beloved disciple, "Behold your mother." And then like when Mary appears to Juan Diego, she says, "Am I not your mother?" You know, there's this idea that she has this maternal love for us. Now, I understand, like, maybe it would be very uncomfortable to have that kind of conversation with your own mom. But what I mean there is that, like, she has an intimate maternal love for you that she's not putting you at a distance. So then the very last thing I'd say here is the best way to get through that is just to get through it. It's just to do it and let it be uncomfortable for a little bit. It's like with anything else. Like, if you want to learn to speak a language, you got to be really bad at it before you're ever good. If you want to learn to dance, you got to be super bad at it before you ever get good. And if you want to pray to Mary, like, it's probably going to feel awkward at first. It's going to be like, I feel like an imposter. I feel like I don't belong. I feel unworthy. Just don't let those things hold you back. You know, the devil is at war with Mary. We get that in Genesis 3:15. We get that in Revelation 12, that the solution to that is to ignore the devil's temptations, to stay away from Jesus, stay away from Mary, and instead go there and be received as one of the lost sheep coming home.
Patrick, I hope that that's helpful to you. I think you will find in the history of the church, and Joe can correct me if I'm wrong on this, that many of the saints, particularly male saints, certainly not only male saints who struggled with sexual sin, but many who did and were in recovery of that, found Mary to be their greatest help. And Yes. And because I think of what Joe just said, she's not uncomfortable around us at all. I mean, she's not uncomfortable around her children, and she just only wills the good for us. I have to go to a break, Patrick, so I will leave it there, but I would like to send you a book called Secrets from Heaven. It's a beautiful book reflecting on the parables and conversations of Jesus from our good friend, Father Sebastian Walsh. I think you'll find this book of great comfort and help. And if you'd like it, just hang on the line and Edgar will send it to you. We'll be right back. We're doing an open forum with those who are coming into the church. I just feel delighted to have had the conversations we've had so far. Looking forward to more conversations. And they don't all have to be delightful. If you're like, well, I'm not delightful, I don't want to call. No, if you got some, you know, something that's sticking in your craw about the Catholic Church as you prepare to come in, or something you're struggling with, having trouble getting over, or just are confused about and would like some help with, that's what we're here for. Open forum for those coming into the church this Easter, 888-318-7884.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What a great grace it is to have the opportunity to use the airwaves for the honor and glory of God, to be able to talk to the hearts of individuals and meet them where they are in their relationship with our Lord, and also to encourage them forward.
Women of Grace with Johnette Williams, this morning, 3 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. We do have three lines open if you want to call with your question. If you're coming, and if it's a simple, basic question, too, please, everything's welcome. We just want to talk to folks who are coming in. It's just basically our excuse to talk to folks who are coming into the church at Easter. So give a call, 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Joe is a well-known apologist and a very fine writer. His latest book is The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, but he's also written a book about St. Joseph, for example, called A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. And he wrote a book about the papacy called Pope Peter. He did that to sell books. That's why he called it Pope Peter, because he knew that was going to sell books. But Joe, answering questions.
You got my get slightly less poor scheme.
Slightly less poor, yes. I don't have a get rich scheme, but I do have a scheme for being slightly less poor. David in Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio, you are next. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, guys.
Hi, David.
I'm entering the church here this Easter.
Thank God. Praise God for
and,
that,
David. Yeah.
What are you entering from, if you don't mind me asking?
I guess non-denominational, somewhere great. Between agnostic and non-denominational most of my life.
Okay. Welcome home, brother.
Thanks. There was something that was making me uncomfortable a little bit recently, though. I was at a Catholic Mass, and after Mass is over, there was a relic they brought out to venerate. And so everyone went up and went to the altar rail and kissed the relic. And the question, I guess, is that I didn't partake. It was a little, I had so many questions. And one, I guess, is how is this not a superstition, that sort of act? And, even if it is not, like, what does it achieve?
These are excellent, excellent questions.
Go
ahead, Joe.
Okay, you can hear me okay?
Yeah.
My webcam is kind of fritzing out right now. I think we're under attack.
Okay. No webcam for Joe.
Yeah, so you're not missing out on
a lot. Which oddly is making the show better. Go ahead. So
anyhow,
yeah, relics.
Yeah, so it's a great question, and I would just say there is a long-standing practice going back not just to the early church but even before, of collecting the things of the saints. So the clearest example of that we get is from Acts 19 verse 12, where even the handkerchiefs or aprons that had touched St. Paul's skin were placed on sick people who were then healed of their diseases and evil spirits were expelled. Those are relics right there. You know, like though these things have touched saints and therefore they're having this transformative effect. They're changing people's lives. They're bringing about these healings. That's what we're doing with relics. But if you go back even before that to the Old Testament with Elisha, we see that his bones, so he's died and someone else is thrown into his tomb. And when this man's dead body touches Elisha's bones, the guy comes back to life. That all of this is rooted in a twofold principle. Number one, that God works through material things. That if you look at the miracles of Jesus, he's using things like spit and mud and all, water and, all of these things. This is why we have the sacraments, but even more so, this is why we have the incarnation, which is the second point, which is that God doesn't just work through material things. He specifically works through people. God is made glorious in his saints. And so he works through the saints, including their bones, including their bodies, including, things that touch them. Just as the woman was able to be healed by touching the hem of Jesus's garment, that God chooses to work in this way because he's meeting us in all the messiness and grittiness of our material reality. That, there's sometimes a view in Protestantism that treats matter as bad, that treats, everything kind of fleshly and material as if it's bad and superstitious to interact with it. And that view doesn't sit easily with the incarnation. That's much more like Gnosticism than it is like Christianity. Like the heart of Christianity from the beginning is that God really does become man. He really takes on a human body. He really, allows himself to be touched. He interacts with bread and wine and water and all of these earthly elements and uses these as vehicles of divine grace.
David, what do you make of that?
That's fantastic. Thank you.
It is fantastic. I'm glad you think so as well. David, thank you very much. Thank you for calling us, and God bless you as you move towards full initiation into the Catholic Church. All right. Bye, David. Let's go to Colorado. Scott in Colorado, listening on 1120 AM. Scott, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Okay. I'm a Protestant, and I'm going to be entering RCIA next fall.
Okay.
And congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I'm trying to wrap my mind around the real presence. I know that's a huge issue. And the way I kind of deal with it is if one is okay with Jesus coming down and being 100% divine and 100% human, then I'm wondering if there's kind of a similar dynamic with the real presence in the Eucharist. It could be fully bread and wine and fully Jesus's presence. Am I on track there, or am I going off the rails?
You're half on track, half off the rails. How about that?
Okay.
I think you're on to something real, but we don't want to press the analogy too far. And the reason we don't want to press the analogy too far is this. The reason that Jesus can be both fully God and fully man is there's nothing in the idea of man and in the idea of God that's incompatible with one another, which is a really strange kind of statement. Bishop Barron, in his book Catholicism, I like the way he puts it. He says, the incarnation tells central truths concerning both God and us. If God became human without seeing...
Hang on, Joe.
Joe, you froze on us for a second,
so you got to go back. If God became, and then you froze. Go right back to the beginning of the quote.
What did I freeze on?
I think you keep freezing on us, Joe. I'm not sure exactly where we are. Sam, I don't know how much of that you got. Okay, Joe, do we have you with us?
Yeah. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah. Okay, but you keep freezing on us.
Okay.
Maybe just turn
I don't know what's going on.
Turn the webcam off for now.
Okay, I'll just turn the camera off completely and we'll...
Yeah, because that uses bandwidth sometimes. So you said, start with the quote that you had given us before.
Yeah, so... Bishop Barron, in his book Catholicism, says the incarnation tells central truths concerning both God and us. If God became human without ceasing to be God and without compromising the integrity of the creature that he became, God must not be a competitor with his creation. And this is a really good insight that, like, the reason that... And then let me give an example with shapes. Something could be like a red triangle and both fully red and fully triangle. Like, it's not 50% red, 50% triangle. It's fully one, fully the other, because they're two radically different things. But something couldn't be 100% red and 100% blue, because those operate on the same level of reality and therefore they're in contradiction with each other. That's why Jesus can be fully God and fully man, but he and we can't be fully man and fully bread, because humans and bread are at the same, they're the same kind of things. And to be bread is actually contrary to be human. Does that distinction help? Because that's the part where we don't want to push the analogy too far. I then want to turn to what you're getting right with that. But does that part make sense as to why those aren't as analogous as they maybe seem on the surface?
Well, yeah, I think because they both exist on the physical plane or physical level.
Right, that's exactly it. That materiality is the kind of principle of distinction here. And so that's the first thing. But the second thing is, and here's where I think you're on to something really good. St. Ambrose talks about how we can trust these sacraments. We can trust the Eucharist and all of that, because Jesus's body is a miracle of itself. Think about the virgin birth. And so... You know, when many Protestants say that the Eucharist seems too far-fetched, you know, well, because, you know, it doesn't appear to be the Eucharist. Well, it's worth pointing out, Jesus doesn't appear to be virgin-born. He has one genetic parent, and yet he's not the same sex as his one genetic parent. His body is a miracle. And so the fact that his miraculous body does miraculous things shouldn't be surprising. So that's the sense that I think you're onto something, that, you know, that's where I would take the analogy, not fully man, fully bread, or fully God, fully man, fully bread, but rather to say Jesus's body is miraculous, and so therefore it's not shocking that the Eucharist should work in a miraculous way.
Okay. That makes sense. Can I ask a second question?
Yeah, we got about 30 seconds, so it's got to be quick, but if Joe doesn't
please
blink out on us, we'll be all right.
Okay. Go ahead. A couple minutes ago, you mentioned Jesus coming down and taking on a second nature, the human nature. I'm just wondering, when he ascended, did he lose that second nature, or does he still retain it?
That's a great question. No, he still regains it. And so he is, at one and the same time, both our intercessor and mediator and God, which is great. It's like having your lawyer be the judge. And so in his humanity, he's able to serve as a mediator for us and as the great high priest. And so all of that continues on even more so in heaven.
Scott, thank you so much. I'm sorry that we had a little bit of technical trouble, but I think we got it done. We'll be right back with more Open Forum for those who are coming into the church at Easter, 888-31-TRUTH.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
The Psalms are very powerful.
Which one means a lot to you?
Tell us tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now more of Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. I'm having a good time with this. I'm glad we did this. This is the first year we've done it. We've done it twice so far this year, and I hope it becomes an annual thing that as we approach the end of Lent. Did something just happen? Oh, the book fell over it. Okay, sorry. Something just happened. I just knocked a book over. That's what that smack was. I didn't slap anybody. I did not go up to Joe and slap him. Don't worry about it. But I really do hope this becomes a thing we do at the end of, approaching the end of Lent, or maybe even the beginning and then again at the end, like we did it this year. I don't know. Because it's just great. I find my own faith enlivened by talking to people coming into the church. Do you feel that way, Joe?
I do. This is really exciting. Just to hear the energy and enthusiasm. Like, it's great to hear people who are saying, here's why I'm not Catholic. But to also hear from people who are like, yes, yeah, I'm on fire. And that's, it's nice to hear too.
Yeah, very, very good. So we've got a half hour left. So, and there are lines open. So if you're coming into the church at Easter, Or if you're, you know, it's not always at Easter for everybody, but if you're coming into the church soon and there's some things you'd like to ask a professional apologist, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Let's go right back to the phones now. We'll go to Jan in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on 89.1 FM. Jan, we're very glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, I am actually through RCIA, but when I went, they did not, they said purgatory wasn't a thing. So can you explain that a little bit? And so say if you go to purgatory, how do you get out of there? And
that would be good to know. Yeah,
yeah,
that would be very good to know. Jan, before Joe answers, I would like to say something about the RCIA process. It's a process. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and I'm not saying this for you, Jan, but for the person who's considering coming in. Some parishes you go to, you're going to get just the top notch, the very best of the best helping you into the church. At others, you will get a little bit of confusion from time to time. Sometimes an occasional agenda that's not the same agenda as the Catholic Church. Catholic Church is a big church, all kinds of people. We're super grateful for all the people who prepare folks for receiving the sacraments. But if you are,
I wouldn't say we're grateful for all of them.
No,
I'm grateful for most of them.
I'm grateful for all of the people. I would like some of them to take more seriously the task of presenting the faith as the church presents the faith and not as maybe we would prefer to present the faith. Because I know this much, Jan, and then Joe can take it from there. Purgatory is for real. I know that much.
Okay.
Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, because I don't
know. One of the reasons he knows that is that that's the title of a book. Oh, okay. Well, I'm happy to explain that. But first, I would like to apologize. Like, you were misserved. Like, imagine if you went to school and your math teacher told you, like, trigonometry wasn't a real thing. And then later you're like, oh, wait.
Wait a second.
It was just, like, some weird view they had, or they just didn't like trigonometry. So I would say, like, it's kind of twofold thing. Like, one, sorry. And two, if you're listening to this and you teach RCIA, please get a catechism, read it, and if what you believe doesn't match up with that, teach what the catechism says, or if you can't in good conscience, humbly bow out and let someone who does believe what the Catholic Church teaches teach what the Catholic Church teaches. Because teaching your own view as the Catholic view when it's not is dishonest, and it gives a disreputation for the church. I'm not sure if that was grammatically coherent, but you know what I'm trying to say. But no, having
that's what we like to hear from our professional apologists. I don't know if that was coherent, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, yeah, you got it.
you get the general idea.
But this is a great mystery, Ephesians 5. St. Paul is just like, he's like, I don't know if any of that made sense to you, but it's like, it's beyond words.
Even St. Paul resorted to it, yeah.
But no, the Catechism actually has a great section on purgatory, beginning in paragraph 1030. And it explains it really nicely in one sentence. All who die in God's grace and friendship, but still imperfectly purified, are indeed assured of their eternal salvation. But after death, they undergo purification so as to achieve the holiness necessary to enter the joy of heaven. Now, let's start at the end and work backwards. The holiness necessary to enter the joy of heaven, Revelation talks about how nothing impure will enter heaven. So if you are saved, if you are in right relation with God, but you are not in a state of purity, you're not going to go to hell because you're in right relation with God, but you're also not ready to stand before the judgment seat. You're not ready to stand, I should say, in the presence of the living God. That there is a process of purification that has to happen. Think about the parable of the wedding feast, where the master throws like a huge wedding feast, and he gathers people from the wayside and brings them in. But then there's a man who shows up without being properly attired in white garment, and because he's not purified, because he's not in the proper garment, he's thrown out. So I would say because of that, we take this idea very seriously. There's other places as well, you know, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where St. Paul talks about the way we build on the foundation of Christ. He's only dealing here with people who are saved, and he talks about how we can build either well or poorly on that foundation, and that if we build poorly on it, we will still be saved, but as through fire. And so the Catechism goes on and says in paragraph 1031, the Church gives the name purgatory to this final purification of the elect. And then points out this is something entirely different than the punishment of the damned. We are not talking about hell here. And that's the cleansing fire that we hear spoken of in Scripture. This also explains why in 2 Maccabees, which is one of those Old Testament books that we as Catholics have that Protestants don't have today, Judas Maccabeus is making atonement for the dead, that they may be delivered from their sin. Now, if the person is already in heaven or in hell, it doesn't make any sense to be making atonement and offering like a purification offering for them. It only makes sense if there's some sort of a purgative state where there's a preparation after death for heaven. And I would just add here that this is the historic Jewish belief. If you go and read the Jewish Encyclopedia, they have a great article, you can get it online, on purgatory, explaining that Jews believe in a purgative process after death. This is one of the things, when you sit Shiva after a person dies, there's a group of 10 people praying for the soul of the person. That notion is something that's older than Christianity, and that Jesus doesn't rebuke, but seemingly reinforces. And it makes sense in light of again, passages like Revelation 22. So then the last part of your question was, what can we do? Well, we can act like Judas Maccabeus. We can pray for those who are in purgatory. Because it's like this. If you know someone right now who maybe they have sinful attachments that they're trying to get rid of, you know that that can be a really painful process for the person. That, you know, they were addicted to something or they had a lifestyle of sin and they're trying to break free of that. That freedom usually arrives very painfully. And one of the things we can do for each other, both for those of us who are, you know, walking around on earth and those of us who have predeceased, is we can pray for those who are in that situation, for God's grace to really ease that journey and to give them all the help that they need.
Jan, is that answer helpful to you? Jan?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm here. There was like a pause. I wasn't sure if he like was finished or if he like cut out.
It's hard to tell with Joe. But
that's true.
How did you find that? Was it helpful?
Yes, it was. Very, very. Well, so I need to get that and read it.
The book Purgatory. The Catechism, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we have a book here that's called, shockingly, Purgatory is for Real. Good news about the afterlife for those who aren't perfect yet. So I'd like to send you a free copy of it if you'd like it.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right. If you'll give Edgar an address to send it to, we will send it off tomorrow. Thanks very much, Jan. And now I forgot what you said. You're coming into the church, or you said you came already into the church, but the RCIA
did.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah, and it was during COVID. I've talked to you before. I've called a lot, I feel like, but it was during COVID. So it was like, we started it. We didn't get a finish. We had to finish through Zoom,
right.
And then I didn't get to get baptized at Easter, and it got pushed back. And then it was like we didn't go to church for the first, you know, the next, 6 months or something. So it was kind of a struggle.
So you're still a baby Catholic for real. I'm glad you survived all that craziness. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, you persevered, though.
A lot and, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, very good.
Well, thank you so much. And yes, I'd love to have that book.
All right. Hang on the line then. Don't go anywhere and we'll send it off to you. I have to take a quick break. So those who are on the line, would you please wait on the line? We want to get to everybody. We're talking with those who are coming into the church this Easter. If you've got questions and you're coming into the church, this hour is for you. We'll return to that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Wherever you are in the world, you can access the EWTN Global Catholic Network. It's everywhere. You can get EWTN's great Catholic programming on your car radio, at home on your TV, computer, or smart speaker. With EWTN's app, you can take EWTN everywhere on your phone or mobile device. If you want your news in print, turn to EWTN's paper of record, the National Catholic Register. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. We're talking with folks who are coming into the church at Easter, just a few weeks left. Sometimes this is a difficult period. Sometimes this is just a joyful period. Don't forget, please, to pray for all those who are coming into the church and all those who are helping them come into the church, but particularly for those who are coming in, because many people can find this an insecure time, an uncertain time, a time where everything kind of comes to a bit of clarifying anticipation here as they're coming towards Easter, and that can be nerve-wracking. And so please pray for those who are coming into the church. Let's go now to Christy in Roswell, Georgia, listening on 1150 AM. Christy, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, Christy.
I have been wondering, I watched the Pope on the Consecration of Russia service.
Yes.
Watched it on the computer, actually. And I know it has something to do with Fatima and Mary's appearances in Fatima. And so I'm wondering what that means, the consecration of Russia. And also, what are we called to do? What does that have to do with us as well? I know there's something having to do with the Catholic people as well. And I'm not Catholic yet, but I'm getting there. So,
are you coming in this Easter, Christy, or?
No, I wish I was, but I'm going to have to wait one more go around, I think, until next Easter. I hope I don't have to wait that long, but.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll say a prayer for you. I'm glad
Thank
you're coming
you.
In. So Joe, make sense of this, the consecration, Fatima, what are we supposed to do?
Yeah. So actually Denver Catholic just had a really good article on this, and it's called, get this, what is consecration and why do it? And it just is like it's great because it has really good quotations in it where it explains where it's not just like the author. They quote Pope John Paul II saying, consecrating ourselves to Mary means accepting her help to offer ourselves and the whole of mankind to him who is holy, infinitely holy. It means accepting her help by having recourse to her motherly heart, which beneath the cross is open to love for every human being, for the whole world. In order to offer the world, the individual human being, mankind as a whole, and all the nations to him who is infinitely holy. And so that consecration literally means to make holy. And so to consecrate something is to dedicate it to God. So like a Marian consecration is invoking Mary's help in giving something over to holiness, to setting it aside for God. We can consecrate churches. We also consecrate ourselves and in this case, when Mary appeared to the seers at Fatima, she warned, this is 1917, right on the cusp of the USSR and all the craziness that was to dominate the 20th century. And she warned that Russia's errors were going to spread unless Russia was consecrated to her, that we needed to entrust Russia to Our Lady to return to God. That Mary was going to intercede, but we were asked to kind of cooperate in this. And specifically, the Pope was asked to consecrate with all the bishops of the world. And so there have been different consecrations in the past that didn't mention Russia specifically. John Paul II had one pretty famously. And so there was a question about whether that was sufficient, because it didn't specifically do the thing Mary asked, but it kind of generally did a consecration of, you know, everybody, that includes Russia. And so now Pope Francis, at the urging of the Ukrainian Catholic bishops, has specifically consecrated Russia and Ukraine to the Immaculate Heart. So we're turning things over to Mary in a real way, not in a way that we just like totally wipe our hands, but like we're asking for her help in a very solemn kind of way. were saying, we need your help. We want this to be a holy nation. We want this to be a place that is, you know, glorifying God. And then in addition, like as part of that prayer, we also offer all humanity because, you know, as the prayer says, like we haven't done such a great job of living out what it is to be Christians, not even treating each other in a human way. So I would say in terms of what we can do, pray, fast, all of that. Additionally, if you haven't prayed the consecration prayer, you can find a copy. The USCCB has one, and you can find it online very easily. And I would just pray it individually or with your family. It's a great personal devotion to share in this giving of, you know, you're taking a situation bigger than yourself. You know, this horrible war going on in Ukraine right now, it's bigger than any of us. And it's one of those things where there's maybe a little we can do. There's not a lot we can do. But one thing we can do that's very powerful is turn it over to God and turn it over to Our Lady to bring to God.
Great. Thank you so much. That's very, very helpful. And I have one more question regarding that. Did the were all the bishops included? I mean, how specific?
They were all invited, yes. So the Pope sent a copy of the prayer to all the bishops in the world, and they worked incredibly quickly to make this available in a wide variety of languages. And don't know of any bishops who didn't cooperate in it. Like, this was something taken very seriously, and I know bishops who already in many cases had very full schedules dropped whatever they were doing to make sure that they consecrated Russia and Ukraine on that day.
Thank you so much. That clears it all up for me. I really appreciate it.
I'm happy to hear that. That's always a pleasure.
We'll call again sometime. All right, Christy?
I will. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And many blessings on your journey into the Catholic Church.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to Pat in Phoenix, Arizona, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Pat, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Did you hear me?
Yep.
Hi.
Very clearly. Yes.
Oh, okay, very good. All right. Well, I'm not a convert to the faith or anything. In fact, I've been a Catholic all my life. But I have a daughter-in-law very soon, April 23rd, that is supposed to marry into the church. And she was supposed to be baptized and confirmed and everything through the RCIA program. But because my son was stationed in Korea, so he had to leave, and she then had to go to New Jersey from because they're both stationed where Texas is. And so she had to leave, and once she left, she stopped doing the online classes. So I spoke to the priest, who's a family friend of ours also, and he said, that's no problem, let her continue. But right now, my son said she's feeling very overwhelmed with everything.
Yeah.
So now what I'm wondering is if she is not baptized in any faith whatsoever, not anything, of no denomination, because her mother mentioned that she was leaving it up to the kids to make that decision.
Can she get married?
Can they still get married in church? Yeah.
Yeah, the technical term for that is a disparity of cult. When you have, that's not just like a mixed marriage. A mixed marriage is like a Catholic and a baptized non-Catholic. Disparity of cult is a Catholic and an unbaptized person. And we're urged circumspection. You don't want to rush into that. St. Paul warns about yoking believers and unbelievers, but it's not an absolute prohibition. And so the Catechism in 1633 and 1634 discusses this. So it's also dealt with in canon law, and it is something that you need to kind of get the appropriate permission for. But if the priest handling the marriage knows about the situation and is approving of moving forward, I assume he's getting the appropriate permission from his bishop and everything. But in other words, it is permitted for good cause with approval, but it's not just like a given, you know, so it should be done kind of cautiously. It's better for her to enter the church, of course, but it's better for her to do that because she actually believes and she's actually open to living a Catholic life, not just to, like, you know, go through the motions to get a church wedding or something like that. So hopefully, in the face of like all of the difficulties in terms of the job and everything with the military, that hopefully the priest can find some way of kind of helping that be as easy and as doable as possible, and hopefully also she takes something as serious as the salvation of her soul, with the kind of gravity to really prioritize it, even amidst all of the chaos of the wedding.
Just make sure maybe that priest has been in contact with the bishop to get that permission, Pat. Let's go. I want to get everybody on, and we've got Carol in Oklahoma next, listening on 97.3 AM. Carol, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello.
Hi, Carol. You're on the air with us.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Are you coming into the church, Carol, this Easter?
Yes, this Easter, yes.
Well, praise God.
That's wonderful.
I know, I'm so excited. I get my third scrutiny this coming Sunday.
Exciting.
Oh. Yeah, I'm so, you've already done a great service to us. To hear someone say how excited they are to come into the Catholic Church, I cannot tell you how that lifts hearts, many, many, many hearts. So God bless you for that, Carol. We need you, and persevere and come into the church. I want to welcome you home. So go ahead with your question for Joe.
I was asking about the prayer of the saints that's out of Revelation chapter 5, verse 8. Because in the Catholic Church, it's always saying, pray to the saints and pray to Mary. And I was just wondering, are they getting released at that point when the Lamb opens the scroll? Or how is that working? That's kind of my question.
Oh, that's a great question. I really appreciate you asking that. So for those who don't remember Revelation 5, verse 8, I'm just going to read it. It says, when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and with golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song saying, and then there's a prayer in verse 9 and 10. We see this idea, and it's a twofold thing. On the one hand, it's a depiction of the heavenly liturgy, and the heavenly liturgy has our prayers. When it says the prayers of the saints, that doesn't there just mean canonized saints that are already in heaven. That also means the saints on earth. When we're praying, there are angels interceding, offering those prayers up before God as an act of worship. Because how beautiful is it that people are saying prayers? Like, how beautiful is it? Like, how much does it actually honor God that we should remember him and we should turn to him for help? That's actually a way that we can really offer a form of worship by treating him with that kind of respect, by recognizing him as who he is. So those prayers are offered up before God. But it does show us also that things are a lot more complicated. like when you pray in Our Father, it's on the one hand going directly to God because, he knows what you're going to pray before you do. And he's able to hear everything you say and know every thought in your mind and every movement. We hear in, Romans, St. Paul talks about the Spirit interceding for us even when we don't know what to pray. So there's something incredibly direct on the one hand, but also something very communal on the other hand, that it's never just private. That even when you're just offering up a prayer mentally, whenever you're offering up a prayer, just even in your room, that's going before the heavenly court. And you've got saints and angels who are praising God. And one of the reasons they're praising God is your prayer. That's why we take things like heavenly intercession very seriously, that the angels and saints who are involved in that can also intercede for us. They can ask God for things for us. They can take our request to God, because that's the kind of thing we see them doing in the Bible.
Okay. So like, say you were saying a prayer, like my son before he died, and I was saying the prayers for him. And I told the Lord, I said, I'll stand in the balance for him. You can pray prayers like that also?
Yeah, that's interceding for somebody, and we're encouraged to intercede for people. One of the great examples of that's a beautiful thing that you did. Abraham, when he is found righteous before God, one of the very next things that happens is he's given an opportunity to intercede for his nephew Lot. Like, that's what we should be doing as Christians. We should be standing for those who maybe struggle to stand for themselves.
Carol, God bless you. Thank you so much for that encouraging call. Thanks to everybody who called. What a great couple of hours. Really grateful to get to hear from folks who are coming into the church at this Easter. Please, again, remember to pray for those coming into the church. And if you are coming into the church, be assured of our prayers. There's lots of people praying for you. Joe Heschmeyer, you're a fine writer and an excellent radio guest. Thanks for doing this with us for 2 hours.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
I think tomorrow we got 2 hours of open forum, right? 2 hours? Is it both hours with Jimmy? 2 hours of open forum with Jimmy? Oh, my gosh. That is, we're on an upward trajectory. Thanks, Joe. Well, I didn't mean it that.
Thanks a lot, Simon. Appreciate it.
See you next time, Joe Heschmeyer. See you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.